find such a love at our age? Whoever thought we could dance on?
Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmers.
Hello, Judy. Hello, viewers and listeners. Judy, tell folks, what is the exciting title of today's podcast?
Well, I don't think we have quite determined that. We're going with, Betrayal and Forgiveness Part 2.
Or Betrayal and Forgiveness, it's almost here.
It's almost here.
Yes. What we're talking about, folks, and I will settle on an actual title to put it when I put it up on the podcast platforms, is the book that I've written, which is, the book is finished. It has been edited. I'm getting the last few bits of comments, but I've already done a bunch of revision. Mm-hmm. The cover has been designed, and I'm going to tell folks right now, first of all, if you are watching the video, you will see the cover magically appear before your very eyes. If you are just listening to the audio of this podcast, go to my blog, brucechalmer.com, and look for the blog tab, or you could just go to brucechalmer.com/blog and scroll down. You will see it when, depending on when you're hearing this, you will see it's one of the more, probably one of the more recent blog entries. Mm-hmm. And you will get to see a picture of the cover, which has now been designed. But it was just wonderful working with that designer, I have to say. Her name's Anne Marie Lamprecht. I don't mind giving her credit.
Shout out to Anne Marie.
Great job. Delight working with her. She came up with all kinds of really neat ideas and refined it and tweaked it, and we've come up with, I think, a really, really nice cover that
and
captures.
And I want to say our listeners were very instrumental in helping us choose those covers. So
they absolutely were. And you know what? For those of you who participated in that poll, I will tell you, there were three concepts we put out. The final result was mostly one of them with some tweaks from another one. But I will tell you, it's really interesting and kind of a tribute to how good the designer was, because the poll results mm-hmm. were almost exactly a third for each one.
Yeah, I know.
It was amazing. It's like another one would come in and it would sort of push it a little bit. You know, I was kind of waiting for the counties outside of Philadelphia to come in to see who was going to be the winner.
Oh, that's overwhelming, but no,
it was,
they were very close.
They were very all close. Very close. And there were some that people absolutely didn't like. I have to say, the only two of the three that anybody really didn't like, mm-hmm. we didn't use.
Right.
Though, frankly, that wasn't completely why. I didn't mind it being a little jarring, but the one that turned out, I don't think is jarring at all. I think it really expresses the concept. Betrayal and forgiveness. You'll see when you look at the cover, betrayal is this sort of stark word, sort of standing out in white on black. And there's a flower that's growing out of forgiveness that's sort of going up into it. And it really expresses a lot of what the book is about.
It
is a book that if you have experienced betrayal, especially if you've experienced betrayal recently, and you are still hurting from that, it's a book that is all about how to get through that. And it offers, as I like to think all my books do, it offers hope.
Yeah.
It offers a sense of this whole living business is doable somehow. And that's a beautiful thing. You can tell I'm really excited about the book. And thank you for your help with it too, as always, of course.
My pleasure.
Yes. So we just want you to know about that. I'm going to talk just a little bit more. If you check out our last podcast, we also did some introducing about what some of the topics in the book were. I'm just going to scan down the table of contents and give you a sense of what it's about. So I start out talking about what betrayal is and the expectations that go into determining if something is a betrayal. And then I talk about, okay, how do you get past the anger, the preoccupation with anger.
Yeah.
And that's really what I mean by forgiveness. How do you get to the point where you can let go of that so you're not preoccupied by anger, whatever you think, or panic whenever you think of the betrayal? And that's all about forgiveness. And I think it's 8 chapters in the book. Chapters 4 through 11 are all about the nuts and bolts, really, of how you decide if you want to forgive, if you should forgive, if you're ready to forgive.
Yeah. I mean, I was just reading the Modern Love column in the New York Times, speaking of betrayal, written by a woman who, when she was 9 months pregnant, her husband cheated on her. She found out about it. He told her when I think the baby was, I don't know, like 6 or 7 weeks old.
Oh, my. Yeah.
And they wanted to stay together.
Mm-hmm.
So they did go for counseling, couples counseling, marriage counseling. and they're still together.
Yeah. But I will tell you that story. I haven't read the article.
Yeah.
Could have been written by numbers of my clients.
Right.
Almost.
I know.
Almost the identical details.
You know, speaking of dealing with betrayal, so, boy, that was. Whew, you know, imagine that they had, you know, fertility issues and, you know, spent years and a lot of money trying to get pregnant and going the IVF route and whatnot. And, you know, here she thought she had this wonderful, loving husband, only to find out not so wonderful, not so loving.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Maybe loving, but not so wonderful.
Well, yeah, it's always interesting and sort of nuanced, you know, like, mm-hmm. How does that happen? You know, how does infidelity happen at all?
Right, but that's like such an ultimate betrayal, you know. Here you are, 9 months pregnant with your child and his child and looking forward to this for years, and then you find out that the rat did you dirt.
I sense some disapproval in your, I know it's subtle, but I think I read some disapproval in your,
you know, people, and you know, she has, I don't know, gotten past it is the right word, but mm-hmm. she's dealing with the betrayal. So yes, it's possible to deal with betrayal. So I was thinking a lot about that because, you know, you've been writing this book about betrayal, and that is right up there with the all-time betrayals.
So, you know, since you bring it up, I haven't read the article, and you have.
Yeah.
So it's not so much how did they, although maybe if that's in there you can say, but I'm curious, how might one, what do you think? How might one, if God forbid you were in that situation, you weren't, neither one of us has been in that situation, but if you were, how might you heal from, how might you come to trust your husband again?
Ooh, well, she said that when they were going for counseling, some things came up that she wasn't aware of in terms of what he was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And had she might have known some of that during the pregnancy, she might have reacted differently.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah. Did they say anything more about that, like what the specifics were?
I can't remember.
That's fine. No, it's fine. No, it's that's really interesting because there is that phenomenon. It's always fascinating when there's
I think it was feelings of inadequacy on his part.
Yeah, it's often something like that where he doesn't bring it up. Often his not bringing it up mm-hmm. is actually, you know, give him some credit in a sense.
Right.
It's that he doesn't want to burden her with it.
Right.
But it makes him, you know, this is a very charitable way of saying it, I think. It makes him vulnerable to the lure of an mm-hmm. affair.
Right.
It doesn't justify it.
No.
And of course, I do.
And he wasn't looking to justify it.
And that's, you know, in terms of.
So in getting over a betrayal, he owned up to his part.
Absolutely.
And how complicit he was in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really crucial. That if, and it's interesting because you can, as I make the point in the book, you can forgive somebody even if they don't, quote unquote, deserve it at all.
Right.
You can forgive somebody if they have no sense of remorse. You would never trust them.
Right.
But you can forgive somebody. The interesting thing is, can you trust them? And if somebody has betrayed you in a way, and I'll have to throw in here, because, you know, for the modern era, there are some folks who would say, why should we make such a big fuss of having sex with someone else? You know, that's kind of what polyamory is about, is recognizing that this whole jealousy thing can be dealt with. It doesn't have to be a panic factor. I actually have a paragraph in the book where I mention I have met folks, especially gay men, but not exclusively. But I have met folks where, and I'm talking about monogamous relationships, where the agreement is monogamy, but somebody strays, you know?
Yeah.
And I've met folks, not only gay men, actually, the occasional heterosexual couple as well, where it's sort of like, you know, you didn't do the dishes, you know? Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, that's annoying. You shouldn't have done that, but, oh, it's not that big deal. It's just sex, mm-hmm. you know? Most folks are not like that for reasons that I also go into in the book.
Right.
But there are folks who are. So it's really interesting to come to trust somebody if it really does feel like a betrayal and you're not going to change your mind that it is a betrayal. You really have to understand, they have to understand that it was a betrayal.
Yes.
And to trust them, you have to say, well, okay, you know it was a betrayal now, and I have reason to believe the circumstances are now different. And even if, you know, if the stuff that was getting in the way of our intimacy came up again, that you would address it with me rather than cheating. And that's what, you know, that's what she would need to know.
Right.
And that's tricky. Again, I talk about that stuff in the book. It's really interesting. I have an example of a couple, several different couples where there's an infidelity involved. And in one case, the person who did the infidelity seems genuinely remorseful, but has no not only no clue about why he did what he did, but he just wants her to believe his protestations that he wouldn't do it again. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't trust that he understands why he even did it.
Well, I think that's where the value of couples counseling comes in,
mm-hmm.
which, as you know,
yes,
it makes a huge difference. But I think a lot of people don't even consider that,
yeah.
and then just say, well, you know, let's end it right here anyway.
Yeah, well, we...
Or can't get past that anger.
Yeah, and it's interesting because another example in the book came from a friend of ours
mm-hmm.
who told about going to her religious leader
right.
when she found out her husband, her then husband, was cheating on her.
Right.
And she had very young children.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just devastated. She didn't know how she was going to make a life without him. And she still loved him. You know, she was mm-hmm. angry, but she still loved him. So she went to her minister, I think I say in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And his response to her was, "You're crazy. You have to you have to divorce. You know,
yeah.
he cheated on you."
Yeah.
In other words, he just urged her to basically
to
be angry and break up the marriage.
Right.
And that was completely useless to her.
Yeah.
Interestingly, she did end up divorcing.
Years later. Right.
And only on terms that made sense to her. But that was an example I gave that, when you're advising somebody who's been betrayed, pushing them to do one thing or the other, pushing them to forgive or pushing them to not forgive, are both pretty useless.
Well, that is what I would call inept counseling.
Yes, exactly.
As you know, you mm-hmm. being a counselor.
I like to think I'm apt.
I'm not a therapist, but...
I try to be an apt counselor.
Right. Like, you're not giving couples advice on what to do.
Right.
You're helping them process what they've been going through.
I'm helping them figure out what to do. And it comes from, and I do mention this in the book too,
mm-hmm.
it comes from genuine respect
mm-hmm.
that I don't claim to know better than they do what they should do with their lives.
Right.
I just don't claim
that. You
can't
live their lives.
No, of course not.
Right.
You'd be amazed. That example was a good example of somebody in a counseling role.
And I hear it all from my friends. My therapist told me to do this. Therapist told me that.
I know.
And it's like, really? Shouldn't your therapist be letting you figure out what to do?
Yeah. And now, I will note, people have quoted me as telling them to do things that I did not tell them what to do. So that does happen. People hear, I'm still responsible for how, for what I say that may get heard or misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
But often, people will infer things that the therapist have said that the therapist didn't really say. There's that. That
yeah.
does happen. But I've talked with therapists directly. I'm all sorts of professional settings.
Sure.
Where they will be telling people what to do from this very high and mighty standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that, not terribly useful, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And it's also, by the way, to other therapists out there, that's a burnout factor. That is a total burnout factor. I know that in my own experience over 30 years, that the times I've been trying to sell somebody a bill of goods
uh-huh.
that they're not buying
right.
are the times that I get frustrated. And when I don't do that, when I'm actually working to connect with the people who I'm actually talking to, it's energizing. It's not, it doesn't, that's why I don't feel any sense of burnout in this work. I still love doing it, and I'm in my 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I have no interest in retiring at this point.
Right.
Because I love the work.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a factor for therapists as well when they're in this, when you're in diagnostic mode and you're trying to put people in categories and then, slot them into what they should do. That can be
right.
incredibly frustrating.
Yeah. And that's why you're such a good therapist.
Well, I thank you for saying so. I've never been your therapist.
No, but
I'm happy to say, licensing board, she's never been my client.
No.
We got together on the up and up. No problem.
Well, you got that yes. nice, am I allowed to say that?
I don't
about
know.
That nice email that you got?
Yes, you can say that, and I obviously can't identify someone.
No, of course not.
This is something that folks might want to hear. And of course, I wrote back to the person who wrote to me. I heard the other day, and this doesn't happen all that often,
mm-hmm.
somebody I saw years ago
yeah.
who just out of the blue wrote me this really appreciative note, email, just saying how much he appreciated the work that they were doing, that when they had come to see me, they were on the brink of divorce. And he really, his motivation in coming to see me with his wife was that he wanted to be able to tell his kids he tried everything possible before
right.
the inevitable divorce,
right.
And it turned everything around. And, I look back and it was just a few sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And I did remember them once I looked them up, actually. But it was really interesting. And it was lovely to get that. And I have to say, it was lovely to get that. Thank you. I obviously can't identify who it was. But it was lovely to get that sort of note. And occasionally that'll happen.
Right.
which is a nice thing to do. So, folks, yeah, if you ever want to write your old therapist who is helpful and just say, hey, thanks a lot. It feels good to get
it
that.
It does feel good because, yeah. You know, so, like you said, sometimes you just don't know what happens with people. They see you for a few times and then they go off and who knows?
Well, and you know, it's funny because the person actually said in his email, it was a man, in his email, he said, I wrote back and I thanked him, but it had been years. And I said, if you feel like saying, like, what prompted you to write? You know, because I thought, what's going, you know, why would he have written, you know? And he said he had just given my contact information to somebody for the fifth time. And he said he's been giving my contact information to people. And he realized in his own work that, you know, when you get positive feedback, it feels really good and you don't often get it, you know? Exactly. So that's really lovely. So I appreciate that sort of thing. So anyway, that we've got all kinds of stuff. We've been kind of talking a lot about what other stuff is in the book. There is also, once I have my eight chapters on how to forgive, I also note that one of the last steps in forgiveness gets us into the general topic of faith. I'm not going to go into any more detail about that other than to say, I'm not talking about religious faith and absolutely not talking about fundamentalist faith, which is, to me, that is an oxymoron. If something is fundamentalist, the way I define faith, it can't be fundamentalist because faith involves accepting the reality that we are limited in our knowledge. We can't possibly know anything for sure. So, you know, it's interesting. At Torah study a week or so ago, one of the people who was there, I think she's a physicist, I believe, right? Or she...
Economist, whatever,
really intelligent academic professor type. And she was talking about how physicists are more and more saying, and I've read some of this stuff too, more and more saying, we don't know stuff.
Yeah.
We think we know stuff. We don't know how it all works. You know, the more they get into these really weird things like in quantum, you know, theory and stuff like that, we don't understand a lot.
Right.
And I just find that kind of gratifying. It's like, of course we don't understand a lot. That's a key to a lot of the therapy I do with folks, is recognizing, you know, we have our, it's funny, I was just having this conversation earlier today with a couple where, and they've been doing great work themselves. I mean, look, the work that happens that heals people, they're the ones doing the work. I'm there helping, you know, they're doing the work. And the work they're doing is really all about loosening up a lot of the categories where, you know, I was commenting on how it's not about disagreeing or agreeing. It's more about, well, I feel this and you feel that, and we've got a whole this blob full of feelings, and isn't that interesting? And yeah, based on that, we're going to do the best we can. But the fact of disagreeing doesn't have to be a crisis.
Right.
And it tends to become a crisis when people panic about it and think, oh no, this is...
You get that hair trigger reaction.
Yeah, exactly. So the ability to sort of soften those categories is a lot about, well, what a lot of, I think, the sort of egghead types, of whom I have some affinity, with whom I have some affinity, especially given that I don't have much hair up there, would call epistemic humility. You know, that notion of epistemic humility, it's like epistemology having to do with what you can know and how you can know it. And epistemic humility is all about saying, yeah, we have to be kind of humble about what we can possibly know. Fundamentalism is the opposite of epistemic
humility.
Well, I
think some people like certainty.
We all like certainty.
Yeah, and are threatened and afraid of the unknown.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, of course we like certainty. And yet, the reality of life is it's full of unknowns. Well, except as they say, death and taxes, you know?
That's it.
And that's the thing, to accept the certainty of death and yet live joyously is a fascinating challenge.
Yeah.
And that's a lot about being in a couple, is about recognizing, wow, there are these differences, some of whom we absolutely celebrate. Vive la différence. I mean, if you're heterosexual, you're looking for that kind of difference right from the get-go.
Yeah.
And also recognizing that some of those differences will cause some friction or cause some annoyance or cause some, you know, unpredictability. And some of that you can just embrace and enjoy, and some of it you can panic about. And my job is to help people not panic about it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you see that in, well, just in society now. And, you know, I've been touring the state at going to high schools and middle schools with this play about the Holocaust. And we were up at a school in a very rural part of the state, which is also to say very white, very non-ethnic. One of the comments that came out from one of the students, I guess her father is, she didn't spe- specifically say where he was from, but it sounds like he's an immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess she has faced a lot of anti-immigrant sentiments from the community, mm-hmm. because it's the unknown,
yeah.
you know? And she said she's so sick and tired of hearing comments on how the immigrants are ruining the United States when her own father is an immigrant.
Well, and of course, everybody, including indigenous people who came from Asia originally,
right.
everybody here is an immigrant,
and
ultimately.
That, and some other kid raised her hand and said, you know, if we look at it, everybody in this country is an immigrant.
Of course.
So I thought that was really nice.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that sense of looking for certainty.
Yeah,
is,
so, you know, we see that a lot going on now with, you know, the rise in anti-Semitism.
We do. And you know what, I'm often, it came up in my conversation with a couple this morning, you know, I'm often at pains to point out to folks, the solution to this stuff, the solution to these tendencies, isn't to reject the tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
It's to incorporate them. It's to understand them. Because why is there racism? Why is there anti-Semitism? Why is there this general sense of, oh, that's different, so
right.
I'm afraid
it's
of it.
It's the other and the unknown.
It's the other. And there's a reason for that. You know, in evolutionary terms, you can't just dismiss that completely. There's a reason why we tend to be, you know, we lump together things. It's not about fairness. We lump together things and, you know, leap to conclusions about things being dangerous when they are in fact not.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, often miss when things in fact are dangerous. But that sort of tendency is not something you can just, you know, extinguish. You have to be able to integrate it, incorporate it. It's like, isn't that interesting? You know, well, yeah, no wonder that bothers you. And there's all these other things too. Isn't that something? You know, that's how it becomes possible to transcend it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the lovely thing about our particular species of primate, which we are, is we have these really elaborate neocortices. You know, all that stuff that's up on top.
Yeah.
And it literally, when you think about the word reflect.
Yeah.
Now here I'm wading into neurological territory and sounding like I know what I'm talking about.
Go right ahead.
Let me put my lack of qualification right there on the table. But I did have, you know, I did have some rigorous courses in physiological psychology back in the Lincoln administration. So, not quite. It was a while ago, though. And the point being, one way of thinking about what's going on electrically mm-hmm. in the neocortex is all this reflection going on. Stuff's going up and down and getting processed and coming back in different, you know, combinations. And so what that gives us the ability to do, several things. It gives us the ability to reason, to figure out complex, abstract, you know, sort of chains of thought. It also gives us the ability to worry ourselves into a total snit. Because, you know,
yeah.
like if you think about most other mammals, like, you know, dogs, people have very close relationships with dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Dogs can certainly be distressed, of course. Dogs
sure.
can worry. Dogs don't worry themselves into a snit over worrying about, you know, who's going to win the next election.
That's true.
Dogs don't worry themselves. They don't worry themselves
they
into a snit.
Themselves
they
themselves about a meal, you know. They,
yeah.
Me.
Well, yeah. Or and I don't even mean yeah. to be cynical. You know, they'll
yeah.
feel, you know, they'll feel bad when someone they love, you know, goes away. They'll
right.
feel you know, not safe. But it's much less reflective than what we're capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for good, but it's also for ill.
Yeah.
And so all of those things, you know, need to be integrated. Anyway, a lot of the book is from that spirit. It's,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are affairs about? I don't go into all sorts of details about what causes affairs. There's other folks who've written about that. It is interesting. I just sort of noted parenthetically, it all affairs, as I perhaps people know this, perhaps they don't. All affairs are not about, let me put the negative in the right place. Not all affairs are about problems in the primary relationship. In other words, people can have happy marriages where they report great sex lives and, you know, happy marriages and still cheat.
Right.
I'm not in any way condoning that. I'm just observing it isn't always so simple. Having said that, when folks come to couples therapy, the vast majority of the people who show up in my office talking about infidelity, there was something wrong in the primary relationship. It often wasn't identified. The couples that can heal from mm-hmm. something like that are the ones who are able to look, I was going to say fearlessly, but there's always a lot of fear, but courageously.
Uh-huh.
You know, courage is about facing the fear, not,
mm-hmm.
you know, not having it.
Right.
So they're able to look courageously at what was going on. And, you know, from the point of view of that woman you were described in that article I haven't read yet, you know, who had been cheated on at 9 months pregnant, for her to be able to look and see, well, there were some issues in her marriage,
mm-hmm.
takes incredible courage, And she had to go do a lot of forgiving to even have that thought. Because, you know, for a lot of folks to say, well, let's look at how the marriage was going before he cheated. I'm thinking, assuming he's the cheater and she's not in this example. And to be able to pull that off, she has to get past the sense of, I don't want to make excuses for him. He's a jerk. He shouldn't have done that.
Right.
And absolutely, it isn't about making excuses. It's we are morally responsible for what we do. But the circumstances we're all part of. And when you can look at that, that's when things can loosen up a bit. And and that's actually when somebody, you know, the person who did it, and actually I'll jump to the end of the book here, or almost the end of the book. I have a whole chapter on what if you're the betrayer. So if you're the one who's done the betraying, then you, there's a chapter in there for you.
Your wife handed you the book and said, here, read this.
I do, as you may recall from reading it, I do say it's quite possible you're reading this chapter because, in effect, your wife handed you the book and said, read this.
That's right.
And I say, you know, welcome. It's possible. Of course, I think, this is just a guess, most of the people who are going to be reading that chapter are the ones who read the rest of the book and are saying, well, what do you say to betrayers?
Right.
You know, I suspect that's going to be the case much more than, you know, the people reaching out for this book are going to be overwhelmingly people who've been betrayed. Mm-hmm. That's my assumption. If you've gone around betraying partners and you want to buy my book, hey, I'll take your money. That's fine. You can do that. And you may benefit from the book, but it's really going to be folks who are reeling from having been betrayed. Mm-hmm. But I do have that section in there. And I do point out in that section, it's good for everybody to read that, you know, whichever, wherever you are in the story, because we've all hurt people.
We have.
You live long enough, you don't have to live that long.
And it doesn't even have to be a spouse or a romantic partner.
Right.
We're talking about siblings, business partners, just anybody in your life, friends. You know, there's all kinds of betrayals. So it's not only about infidelity.
That's right. And
so
I do
just want to stress that as we're talking about couples in this right now.
Yes.
But it's betrayal across all different categories.
Yeah. In fact, I'm awaiting a blurb from someone who has, it's not her story in the book, of course, but somebody who, where there's a similar story in the book. Mm-hmm. Then I looked up other possible stories based on her story, mm-hmm. where she had been disinherited.
Yeah.
And she's a great author herself, and I really wanted to get a blurb from her, and she's promised me one. So by golly, thank you. I won't say your name. but you'll see it in the ads. So having said all that, please be on the lookout. I will, of course, we will make great fanfares worth of announcements on this podcast when the book is actually released, or when we have a release date. I don't have the release date exactly yet. And we will also, you know, be putting it out on my mailing list. By the way, sign up for my mailing list. Go to our website, ctn7.com, and you can sign up for Dr. Chalmers' mailing list, and you will be alerted as to when the book is coming out. And so please get a hold of that book. Let's put in a word for the books that are already available.
Sure. Which
one? A couple of mine and
first?
One of yours. So
how about we talk about Reigniting the Spark? Why stable?
That's it. Why stable relationships?
Why stable relationships lose intimacy and how to get it back?
Absolutely. That's, as you often refer to it, the book that
book
started it all.
Started
which
it all.
Started the podcast. Anyway.
Yes, actually, yes.
Yeah.
That was the impetus for our podcast.
And more recent
there was
book.
Your recent book, It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy is Wrong.
Yes, Reigniting the Spark is, as the name implies, about, you know, how to feel better in a relationship in lots of different ways. Mm-hmm. It's not about communication. It's much more about what's therapy about and what's therapy perhaps not about or maybe oughtn't to be about. And how do you understand that? How do you make use of therapy? So if you want to be a good consumer of therapy, that's a really good book to use.
Mm-hmm.
And this upcoming book, I don't know if I said the whole, did I say the whole title?
I don't think I did. You did.
The title of the new book is Betrayal and Forgiveness, How to Navigate the Turmoil and Learn to Trust Again. And so that is soon to be coming. And let's not forget to put in a plug for our sponsor.
My book, The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
Also known as Judy. And a beautiful, beautiful erotica. I actually, you haven't seen the acknowledgments page yet. But I put a mention of your writing beautiful erotic fiction in the acknowledgments page because I think it's just relevant. And yes, if you like erotica, and this is classy erotica. It is very explicit. I'm not, it's not like.
But it's not like kinky, because I know some people are turned off by that.
Yes, it is not. It is not indeed. Yes, it's not at all particularly kinky, right? And it is based on biblical stories and reflects your very deep knowledge and love of Torah and Jewish knowledge and biblical knowledge in general. And it's so interesting as you were writing it, and we were laughing about it sometimes because we'd be encountering in Torah study, mm-hmm. Some midrash, look it up folks if you don't know what midrash is, some midrash about some particular characters and comment, you don't have to make this stuff up. It's already there in the text, or it's already there in the midrash.
There.
But you certainly did expand upon it beautifully. And so if you like erotica, you will love that book.
And if you've never read erotica, this is a good intro.
It is a good intro. And you can get that at lariazilber.com. LariaZylber, lariazilber.com. Or you can just search for it on Amazon. If you search for The Blue Tent Erotic Tales from the Bible, now don't just search for The Blue Tent or you will get
Blue Tent.
They will show you merchandise, Blue Tents. You don't want that. No, The Blue Tent Erotic Tales from the Bible, it will pop up and you can purchase it that way. And it is available, as all the books we've mentioned so far are available,
in all
of your favorite formats. Kindle and audiobook, and of course, on paperback. And the audiobook for your book, you did the beautiful narration.
And the audio for your books.
And I did the narration
for
mine.
Narration.
Exactly, yes. So.
And we're told we have nice voices.
That's what people have told us, and that encouraged us both to do those narrations, by golly. And it's not mere coincidence that you referred to, going around in a performance where you, in fact, are the narrator of the performance. And they knew just who to call to get a really wonderful narrator for that sort of thing. So I think what else we want to tell people? Just, hey, tell folks about our podcast.
Right. Like us, share us, follow us.
Absolutely. And so until next time.
Remember, be kind.
Don't panic.
And have faith.